ਵੇਖਾਂ ਬਲੀ ਰਣਜੀਤ ਨੇ ਰਾਜ ਭਾਗ ਦੀ ਵਾਗ ਹੱਥ ਆਪਣੇ ਵਿੱਚ ਲੈ ਲਈ ਪਏ ਨਸੀਬੇ ਜਾਗ ਵੱਡ ਇਰਾਦੇ ਸਿੰਘ ਦੇ ਬਾਹੀ ਵੱਡ ਬਲਕਾਰ ਗਿਰਦੇ ਇਕੱਠੇ ਕੱਲ ਲਏ ਵੱਡੇ ਤੇਗ ਖਿਡਾਰ ਵਿਆਹ ਹੋਇਆ ਬਲਵਾਨ ਦਾ ਉਸ ਸ਼ੇਰਨੀ ਨਾਲ ਪੋਤੀ ਜੋ ਜੈ ਸਿੰਘ ਦੀ ਭਖਦੀ ਜੋਤ ਜਵਾਲ ਸਦਾ ਕੌਰ ਦੀ ਲਾਡਲੀ ਘੋੜਿਆਂ ਦੀ ਅਸਵਾਰ ਜਾਈ ਮਰਦ ਦਲੇਰ ਦੀ ਤਿੱਖੇ ਨੈਣ ਨੁਹਾਰ ਹਰਕ ਦ ਬ੍ਰੇਵ ਰਣਜੀਤ ਸਿੰਘ ਹੀ ਟੇਕਸ ਚਾਰਜ ਆਫ ਹਿਸ ਫੇਟ ਆਫ ਹਿਸ ਕਿੰਗਡਮ ਗ੍ਰੈਬਸ ਦ ਰੇਨ ਫੇਮ ਐਂਡ ਫੋਰਚੂਨ ਬੋਥ ਅਵੇਟ ਇਨ ਹਿਸ ਮਾਇੰਡ ਆਰ ਲਾਫਟੀ ਗੋਲਸ ਇਨ ਹਿਸ ਆਰਮਸ ਦੇਰ ਇਜ ਮਚ ਮਾਈਟ Around him there are gathered swordsmen keen to fight. The mighty one is married, a tigress is his queen, grandchild of great Jai Singh, fiery is her mien. Apple of Sada Kaur's eyes, on horses she is seen, daughter of a warrior, blessed with beauty keen. Sada Kaur da taan hun, ਰਲਿਆ ਸਿੰਘ ਦੇ ਨਾਲ ਸੀਨੇ ਵਿੱਚ ਚੜ੍ਹਦੀ ਕਲਾ ਲੱਗੀ ਦੇਣ ਉਛਾਲ ਸ਼ਾਹਜ਼ਮਾਨ ਦਾ ਰੇੜਕਾ ਫਸਤਾ ਗਿਆ ਮੁੱਕ ਰਾਜ ਬਿਥਾਰਨ ਦਾ ਬਲੀ ਬੀੜਾ ਲੈਂਦਾ ਚੁੱਕ ਸਦਾ ਖੋਰਸ ਪਾਵਰ ਐਂਡ ਮਾਈਟ ਇਜ਼ ਐਟ ਹਿਸ ਬੈਕ ਐਂਡ ਕਾਲ ਸੋਰਿੰਗ ਆਰ ਹਿਸ ਸਪਿਰਿਟਸ The warrior standing tall, Shah Zaman's churning is done, ended have his dreams. Now it is his time to rule, ready the hero seems. Shah Zaman pichho ja mudeya, pangi vi mud aaye, fer Lahore malleya ona hisse vand vadaye, paate tidke aapo vichi, kuram kura hoye, kamzori ne ਆਣ ਰਾਣਿਆ ਚੂਰਾ ਚੂਰਾ ਹੋਏ ਕੰਡ ਕਰਦੇ ਨੇ ਪਰਜਾ ਵੱਲੇ ਮੂਰਖਤਾ ਵਿੱਚ ਵਿਜੇ ਹਰ ਪਾਸੇ ਬਦ ਅਮਣੀ ਫੈਲੀ ਕੱਲੇ ਕਲਹੀਣੀ ਸਿੱਜੇ ਐਸ ਸੂਨ ਐਸ ਸ਼ਾਹ ਜ਼ਮਨ ਹੈਡ ਲੈਫਟ ਟੂ ਰਿਟਰਨ ਦ ਭੰਗੀਸ ਫਰੀ ਵਾਂਸ ਅਗੇਨ ਦੇ ਟੁੱਕ ਲਾਹੌਰ ਦੇ ਸਪਲਿਟ ਇਟ ਇਨ ਟੂ ਪੀਸਿਸ ਥਰੀ ਅਮੰਗ ਦੈਮ ਬ੍ਰੇਕ ਆਊਟ ਸਕੁਆਬਲਸ ਦ ਭੰਗੀਸ swear and roar disunity their weakness rancor strife and ruin galore their subjects harried hounded foolish is their rule discontent turmoil abound contentiousness and tyranny cruel hain kasuriye pue hoye bahut mansoobe karde kho lahore lavo pangiyan to par kuch vichon darde ਪਤਾ ਉਹਨਾਂ ਨੂੰ ਸਿੰਘ ਦੜਕ ਰਹੇ ਦੇਸ ਅੰਦਰ ਚੁਫੇਰੇ ਪੰਜ ਦਰਿਆ ਦੀ ਧਰਤੀ ਹਿੱਲੇ ਕੋਈ ਨਾ ਅੱਗੋਂ ਵਿਹਰੇ ਪਰ ਜੇ ਦਾ ਲੱਗੇ ਤਾਂ ਸਮਝਣ ਗੱਲ ਨਾ ਕੋਈ ਮਾੜੀ ਇਸੇ ਲਈ ਉਹ ਕਰਨ ਲੱਗ ਪਏ ਵਿੱਚੋਂ ਵਿੱਚ ਤਿਆਰੀ ਐਕਸਾਈਟਡ ਆਰ ਕਸੂਰਸ ਪਠਾਨਸ ਗਲੀਫੁਲੀ ਦੇ ਪਲਾਟ ਐਂਡ ਪਲੈਨ Fearful yet wonder, sees Lahore, perhaps we can. Mighty roaring Singhs are spread in directions four. No one can before them stand. Shakes the land their mighty roar. Hopefully they plot and scheme. Maybe fate will on us smile. Just in case they get a chance, they make their plans hostile. ਕੁਝ ਮੌਲਵੀ ਅਤੇ ਮੁਲਾਣੇ ਗੱਲ ਇਹ ਸਿੱਖ ਕੇ ਕੱਲੇ ਮੁਸਲਮਾਨ ਗੰਢ ਸ਼ਹਿਰ ਦੇ ਜਿੱਤੀਏ ਫੇਰ ਸੁਖੱਲੇ ਵੱਡੀਆਂ ਵੱਡੀਆਂ ਬੰਨਾਂ ਵਾਲੇ ਕੌੜ ਪਠਾਨ ਜੁਸ਼ੀਲੇ ਗੱਭਰੂ ਭਖਦੇ ਮੂੰਹ ਜਿਨ੍ਹਾਂ ਦੇ ਵਿਉਂ ਵਾਲੇ ਗਰਭੀਲੇ ਜੰਗ ਕਰਨ ਦੀ ਕਰਨ ਤਿਆਰੀ ਸਾਣੀ ਚਾੜਨ ਤੇਗਾਂ ਜੇ ਲਾਹੌਰ ਅਸਾਂ ਹੱਥ ਆਵੇ ਆਖਣ ਵੱਡੀਆਂ ਦੇਗਾਂ ਗੁਜਰਾਂ ਵਾਲੇ ਵੀ ਇਹ ਖਬਰਾਂ ਤੱਤ ਫੱਟ ਪੁੱਜ ਗਈਆਂ ਸ਼ੁਕਰ ਚੱਕੀਏ ਵੀਰ ਬਲੀ ਨੇ ਕੰਨ ਡਾਹ ਕੇ ਸੁਣ ਲਈਆਂ ਸੱਦ ਸਰਦਾਰਾਂ ਅਤੇ ਪੈਂਚਾਂ ਨੂੰ ਬੈਠ ਸਲਾਹਾਂ ਕਰਦਾ ज्यों लाहौर मिले मनसूबा ओ सब मोहरों तरदा आखे सुनो साथियो सजनो वीरो सिंह सरदारो कमरा कसो छंडो बाहां जोदे बाण प्रण धारो मौलवीज एंड मुल्लाज आर थस हर्ड टू डिक्लेयर मुस्लिम्स ऑफ लाहौर यूनाइट टू फेस अस नन विल डेयर Strong, alert, mighty Pathans with exuberance filled, heroes with their mouths aflame, eager and strong-willed, raise their swords ready to fight, preparations make, offerings of food we'll give, when Lahore we take. Swiftly are the tidings brought to Gujranwala Fief, takes note of the battle plans the Shukar Chakia chief, Summoned our commanders, war council is held. I am, he says, to his men, to take Lahore impelled. Addresses friends and comrades, sings that are gathered there. Gird your loins, flex your arms, to fight as mighty warriors swear. Mar kangura ik bolya, hath liya vela. ਇਸਨੂੰ ਸਾਂਭ ਅਗੇ ਹੋ ਕੇ ਕਰੀਏ ਜਨਮ ਸੁਹੇਲਾ ਛੰਡ ਬਾਹਾਂ ਰਣਜੀਤ ਸਿੰਘ ਨੇ ਗੱਜ ਲਲਕਾਰਾ ਲਾਇਆ ਮਾਨੋ ਬੱਬਰ ਸ਼ੇਰ ਬੁੱਕਿਆ ਰਿਸ ਜਾਗੀ ਗੁਰਰਾਇਆ ਜਿੱਤ ਸਾਡੇ ਪੈਰ ਫੜਨ ਲਈ ਵਰਿਆਂ ਮੋਹ ਉਮਲਾਹੀ ਇਸ ਘੜੀ ਪ੍ਰਥਕ ਜਾਪਦਾ ਸਤਿਗੁਰ ਹੋਏ ਸਹਾਈ ਪਰ ਆਪਾਂ ਲਾਹੌਰੋਂ ਪਹਿਲਾਂ ਪੁੱਜੀਏ ਕੱਲ ਵਟਾਲੇ ਸਦਾ ਕੌਰ ਮਾਤਾ ਨੂੰ ਮਿਲੀਏ ਜਿੱਤੀਏ ਸ਼ਹਿਰ ਸੁਖਾਲੇ ਨਾਲ ਉਹਨਾਂ ਦੀ ਫੌਜ ਰਲਾ ਕੇ ਆਪਣਾ ਤਾਣ ਵਧਾਈਏ ਮੁੜ ਲਾਹੌਰ ਉੱਤੇ ਸ਼ੇਰਾਂ ਜਿਉਂ ਉੱਡ ਕੇ ਝਪੜ ਚਲਾਈਏ ਬੋਲਡਲੀ ਅ ਸਿੰਘ ਵਾਸ ਹਰਟ ਟੂ ਸੇ ਐਨ ਓਪਰਚੁਨਿਟੀ ਗਾਡ ਹੈਸ ਸੈਂਟ ਸੀਜ਼ ਦ ਮੋਮੈਂਟ ਬੀ ਫੁਲਫਿਲਡ ਟੂ ਡੂ ਦਿਸ ਯੂ ਵਰ ਮੈਂਟ Flexed his arms, Ranjit Singh, his roar meant to inspire, like an angry lion seemed, aroused had been his ire. Victory will kiss our feet, boldly he declared. At this moment to help us, the Guru seems prepared. But before we take Lahore, to Batala we will go. With Sadar Kaur we'll take Lahore and vanquish every foe. When our armies are combined, fearsome will be our might. To Lahore, like hungry lions, we will take the fight. Before Shah Zaman had launched his last expedition to India, he had tried to settle the affairs of Herat, which had been under the control of his rebellious half-brother Mahmud Mirza. Shah Zaman had conferred the governorship of Herat upon his son, Prince Qaisar Mirza, prompting Mahmud and his son, Kamran, to seek refuge in Persia. The invasion of Khorasan by Sheikh Fateh Ali Qajar of Persia, prompted by British efforts, which had recalled Shah Zaman from Lahore, was starting to falter. The Shah of Persia turned back from Sabzwar, but Mahmud Mirza, intent on taking the throne of Kabul, redoubled his efforts and raised an army 10,000 strong in Persia with the help of Mir Ali Khan of Qaim. Mahmud Mirza defeated Prince Qaisar in battle, who, despite the popular support for Mahmud in Herat, managed to hold the city. Qaisar's wily vizier drafted a letter, purportedly from Mir Ali Khan, offering to assassinate Mahmud and Kamran, and made sure that it fell into Mahmud's hands. Completely fooled by the stratagem, Mahmud and Kamran fled for their lives, ending the assault on Herat as Qaisar Mirza routed the Persian army. Mahmud and Kamran sought refuge with Shah Murad of Bukhara, who welcomed them warmly, but was forced to ask them to leave when Shah Zaman demanded that he turn them over. Mahmud returned to Persia and decided to bide his time. The invasion of India had failed, and Shah Zaman was no closer to regaining the Punjab than his father, Timur Shah had been during his lifetime. But in Afghanistan, he now reigned supreme. The challenge from Mahmud had ended, and Shah Zaman's position seemed secure. Raj Kaur knew that she had lost, but the daily humiliations were becoming increasingly harder to take. As proud as she was of her only son, her jubilation at his great victories against the Afghans was tempered by her resentment at being sidelined. In the old days, Sardar Dal Singh had at least made a show of consulting her, but now she was not even invited whenever a war council was held at Gujranwala. Her deepest resentment, however, was reserved for Sada Kaur, her one-time friend, who had firmly insinuated herself into her son's life and had virtually usurped her position in the Shukr Chakia household. How she missed Diwan Lakhpat Rai! The minister had refused to be cowed down by Sardar Dal Singh, and he would have never deferred to Sada Kaur like the men who surrounded her son now did. She thought she had won a great victory when she had induced her son to marry a second time. The daughter of the Nakais, who was known as Datar Kaur after her wedding, was as sweet and respectful as her first daughter-in-law Mehtab Kaur was haughty and aloof. Ranjit Singh, who had had an uneasy relationship with Mehtab Kaur, had taken to his new bride, and as far as Raj Kaur could tell, they had a harmonious marriage. While her goal had been to counter Sada Kaur's influence through the alliance with the Nakais, the consequences had not exactly been what she had been hoping for. Sada Kaur was embittered, of course, but her daughter really took the second marriage as a personal affront. Already at odds with her husband, she started spending most of her time at Sada Kaur's estates in Batala. This was not something that pleased Raj Kaur, for it was important for Ranjit Singh to have heirs, and she would have liked to see both of her daughters-in-law become mothers. There was a flurry of activity in the household, but Raj Kaur was unaware of the reason. The young Brahmin, who had taken over the supervision of the day-to-day affairs of the household after the flight of Mr. Laikram, was scurrying around giving instructions to the kitchen staff. Raj Kaur realized that she did not even know the fellow's name. "What are these preparations for, son?" she asked the man, managing to hide her irritation. "The Sardar Sahib had asked for preparations to be made for the evening, Mataji," he said respectfully. "Of course," said Raj Kaur, pretending that she knew what was going on. Her son was discreet, she knew, and though he indulged himself freely in all the passions that the other young chiefs did as well, he was careful to avoid doing anything to offend her sensibilities. She was certain that the event was not a notch or a dance by courtesans. It was probably a meeting with his closest advisors, to which, of course, she had not been invited. Raj Kaur instructed her attendants to keep a close watch on the comings and goings, fully expecting that she would get reports of Sada Kaur's arrival. But there was no sign of the leader of the Kanhiyas all day. In the evening, one of her attendants reported that Sardar Dal Singh had arrived from Akalgarh, as well as Sardar Jamal Singh Kanhiya from Kalanaur, and several subordinate Shukr Chakia chiefs, many of whom had once paid tribute to the Bhangi Sardars. Something was afoot, and Raj Kaur decided to swallow her pride and go to the council uninvited. As she approached the large studded door that led to the audience hall where the meeting was taking place, she found her way blocked by two young warriors who looked at her in confusion. She imperiously held up her hand when one of them started to stammer, and she stalked into the hall as the warriors meekly stood aside. A shadow flitted across the young Shukachekia chief's face briefly, but he quickly regained his composure and rose to welcome his mother, who smiled graciously and sat in the space next to him, which had hastily been vacated by one of her son's vassals. Just then the doors to the hall opened again, and in walked Sadakor to the consternation of Rajkor, and after being respectfully greeted by the assembled chiefs, took a seat on the other side of Ranjit Singh. "I am sure Shah Zaman will return again," said Ranjit Singh. "But until he does, we have an opportunity. I have asked all of you to assemble here today so that we can decide where to turn our attention." The discussion was long and convoluted, and many ideas were put forward. Most of the chiefs were of the opinion that with the power of the Bhangis on the decline, the time was ripe for the Shukachekias to establish complete supremacy between the Ravi and the Indus before Shah Zaman's next invasion. Sardar Milkha Singh, the formidable chief of Rawalpindi, who Ranjit Singh addressed as Babaji, spoke forcefully.
"Jodh Singh of Wazirabad is your kinsman, but he betrayed your father, and it is unclear where his sympathies lie," said Sardar Milkha Singh. "Gujarat should be an ally, because Sahib Singh Pangi is your uncle by marriage, but he will have to be subdued as well. After you have taken Chiniot from Jassa Singh Pangi and Sialkot from Karm Singh and Sodh Singh, you can start thinking about Chang, Bahawalpur and Multan." There was a buzz of conversation after Sardar Milkha Singh put his proposal forward, and then Sadakor spoke. "With all due respect, Sardar Sahibs, your suggestions are worthy, but I would like to ask you to think more boldly. With my support and encouragement, Ranjit Singh has made a name for himself by taking on the might of the Afghans. Our son has already received a farman from Shah Zaman declaring him the ruler of Lahore. Of course, Lahore is not his to give, but if Ranjit Singh were to take the city, he would become the most powerful chief in Punjab."
"A chief?" asked Raj Kaur, interrupting. "Do not diminish my son by calling him a chief. He is a king. He is the grandson of Raja Gajpat Singh of Jind. Sardar Hari Singh, Chanda Singh, and Ganda Singh were called Badshah during their lifetimes. Sardar Maha Singh was no less than a king, every bit an equal to the Rajas of Jind, Nabha, and Patiala. It was to my father, Raja Gajpat Singh, that he turned to for advice, and it was on his prompting that his subordinate chiefs were put on a salary. Gujranwala has a treasury, and everything that is won in war is sent to it. It has a Diwan. It was already a kingdom when Sardar Maha Singh breathed his last. Do not call my son a chief. He is already a king, and he is destined for glory." Ranjit Singh raised his hand, demanding silence.
"I have great respect for you, mother, and I thank you for your blessings, but we have to be pragmatic. The Afghan threat is not yet over. And yes, the Pangis have been weakened, but they wield considerable power. There is much wisdom in Babaji's words. For now, we will focus on consolidating power around us, and if Waheguru wills it, maybe one day we can also dream of taking Lahore." Just a year after his arrival in India, the British Governor General Wellesley had put sweeping changes in place which would serve the East India Company well during his tenure and after. John Shore's timid policy of non-intervention had completely been abandoned, and the British had boldly adopted an expansionist stance. Wellesley had quickly grasped upon his arrival that there were three Indian powers that he primarily needed to contend with: Nizam Ali Khan Asif Jah II of Hyderabad, Tipu Sultan of Mysore, and Daulat Rao Sindhia of Ujjain and Gwalior. Each of these rulers had built crack sepoy brigades under the command of French generals, which included artillery and infantry. The Nizam's brigades were commanded by General Raymond and Sindhia's by General Perron. Tipu Sultan had been defeated and killed in the Fourth Anglo-Mysore War, and Wellesley's attention was focused on the Nizam and Daulat Rao. Detailed instructions were sent to Colonel Palmer, the British resident at Pune, and J.A. Kirkpatrick, the resident at Hyderabad, which laid out Wellesley's goals and game plan. The Nizam was ill, and the British contrived to have his minister, Mushirul Mulk, an Anglophile, take center stage. Wellesley's main weapon in the implementation of his expansionist policies was the so-called subsidiary alliance system, which was modeled broadly after the arrangement that the British East India Company had in place with Awadh, their closest ally in India. Wellesley was particularly keen in bringing the Marathas and the Nizam of Hyderabad under the umbrella of his new system. Indian states that subscribed to the system would have to give up all external relations unless approved by the British. They were prohibited from waging war and had to maintain a standing army commanded by British officers, which would be funded through land grants. The states would have to accept a British resident at court, who would act as a senior advisor and oversee the maintenance of the army. No European officers could be hired without the approval of the British. Even as Wellesley had been preparing to go to war with Tipu Sultan, his representatives were diligently working with the courts of Pune and Hyderabad, trying to get them to accept the subsidiary alliance with the British. At that time, however, Wellesley was unaware of the new power rising in the West that the British would have to contend with. Mian Muhammad Ashik, a familiar figure at Lahore Fort, was waved in by the two warriors guarding the humble postern gate close to the magnificent Hathi Pao through which the Mughal emperors used to ride into the fort mounted on elephants in days past. Usually an affable man with a courtly demeanor, the Mian looked perturbed, his brow dark. He made his way to Musamman Burj, which his father had told him had been built by the Emperor Shah Jahan during the glory days of the great Mughals of Delhi. Mian Muhammad Ashik came to a halt at the entrance of the magnificent Sheesh Mahal, which he was very familiar with, as the way forward was blocked by two young warriors. Mian Muhammad Ashik saluted the guards and respectfully introduced himself. "Please let Sardar Chait Singh know that Mian Muhammad Ashik is requesting an audience." The guards nodded and told him to wait. Getting more irritated by the minute and trying to keep his composure, he stood by the guards for more than 45 minutes before the door to the Sheesh Mahal was thrown open and he was let in. He could never help feeling small and insignificant every time he stepped into the magnificent hall, its walls and ceiling decorated with a mosaic of glass. While he could never dare to share his inner feelings with the six sardars who ruled Lahore, he often wondered what the courtly and sophisticated Mughal kings were thinking as they looked down from the heavens upon the new occupants of their magnificent palaces. He pushed the thoughts from his mind and bent low to salute Sardar Chet Singh, who was lounging against a pile of carelessly strewn cushions. Chet Singh looked at the Miah, a frown on his face.
"It is time for me to retire, Chaudhary Saab, and you know that I never receive visitors this late at night. What is it that could not wait until morning?"
"Huzoor," Miah Muhammad Ashik began, "it has been 3 days since my son-in-law Badruddin was arrested. Sardar Saab, my daughter has neither eaten nor slept this entire time, and we are all beside ourselves with worry. I'm here to beg for his release, for we have not even been told what his fault is. Whatever it is, Sardar Saab, I will guarantee his good conduct personally if you release him into my custody."
Chet Singh regarded Miah Muhammad Ashik balefully. "Are you my faithful subject, Chaudhary Saab?"
"Huzoor, how can you even doubt that? Everybody knows that Miah Muhammad Ashik is every bit as faithful to you as he was to your father."
"Perhaps that's true. Yet, did you not wait upon Shah Zaman in this very Samman Burj and present nazars when he held court?"
"But what could I do, Huzoor? His Royal Highness had taken the city and the fort. All the leading citizens were commanded to attend court and present nazars. If I had not, I would have been dragged before him in chains. You know that, Sardar Saab."
"Yes, indeed. The Afghans are known for their cruelty, and so you obey them without question. Perhaps my father was too lenient. Perhaps I was too."
"Huzoor, we have been praying for your return to Lahore."
"Are you sure, Chaudhary Saab? I have heard that you and several of the other leading Muslim Chaudhries have indeed been praying, but for the return of Shah Zaman."
"That is untrue," protested Miah Muhammad Ashik. "I cannot speak for anyone else, but I am your faithful subject, and I hold you, Sardar Mohar Singh and Sardar Sahib Singh, in high esteem."
"Can you speak for your son-in-law, though?"
"I do not understand, Huzoor."
"I have received credible reports that Mir Badruddin has been sending letters to Shah Zaman, beseeching him to return and free Lahore from the rules of kafirs."
"This is a lie, Huzoor. Badruddin would never do this. Please allow him to confront his accusers. I am sure this is a misunderstanding and it will be cleared up."
"I am not a child, Chaudhary Saab. A delegation of 11 of the leading Khatris of Lahore met me personally and denounced him. These are men that I trust and they all spoke in one voice. Besides, they showed me letters they had intercepted written by your son-in-law."
Miah Muhammad Ashik begged and pleaded, insisting that the letters had been forgeries. But Chet Singh would not relent, for in his mind, Badruddin had committed treason by trying to invite Shah Zaman back. When Miah Muhammad Ashik got home, his daughter took one look at his face and crumpled into a heap. "Don't worry, my child," he said. "This is a misunderstanding and it will be cleared up. Tomorrow, I will collect all the principal Chaudhries of Lahore and we will petition Sardar Chet Singh as a group. He will listen to us." Miah Muhammad Ashik spent the better part of next day reaching out to the most prominent citizens of Lahore. Accompanied by Meher Mohkamuddin of Nawankot, Chaudhary Kakka, Ibrat Khan, and several others, he presented himself at Lahore Fort again. Their petition fell upon deaf ears, for Chet Singh had made up his mind. As far as he was concerned, Badruddin was guilty, and nothing would change that. Several more attempts were made for the next 30 days, after an irritated Chet Singh responded with coarse and insulting language. The Chaudhrys of Lahore decided that they needed to take a different approach. They met at the home of Hakim Hakam Rai and drafted a petition. The chaos at the Maratha court in Pune continued unabated because of internal dissensions, and to make matters worse, the British threat was looming large. Emboldened by the victory against Tipu Sultan, Wellesley sent a proposal to Peshwa Bajirao II. Mysore had been handed back to the Hindu Raja, who had preceded Tipu Sultan, and some of his territories were offered as an inducement to the Peshwa if he signed the subsidiary treaty with the British and agreed to side with them if they ever went to war with the French in India. Further, he was required to give up his right to levy tribute upon Mysore, and in the event of a dispute with the Nizam of Hyderabad, he would have to abide by any decision the British made. It was an insulting offer which would have virtually ended Maratha independence, and Bajirao demurred, Daulat Rao Sindhya siding with him. Nana Fadnis, old but still astute, tried to explain to the two young men that Tipu Sultan's defeat was a measure of the power of the British, and it would be impossible for the Marathas to resist their might, but his warnings fell on deaf ears. Bajirao made several ineffectual attempts to build a coalition of Indian states against the British, but he was stymied at every step. While Daulat Rao Sindhya was desperately trying to come up with a strategy to counter the British, all the while dealing with the intrigues of the Pune court, a powerful Maratha rival was continuing to rise. Jaswantrao Holkar, the third son of the late Tukoji Holkar, Madhaji Sindhya's bitter rival, had earlier left Pune with his brother Vitoji and several other Holkar chiefs for Jejuri, the seat of their family deity. After swearing vengeance against the Sindhyas for the death of his brother Malhar Rao, the penniless Jaswant Rao wandered around with his companions until he managed to take firm control of Indore and the Holkar state. That was when he had joined the war of Mataji Sindhya's widows against Daulat Rao Sindhya, making common cause with the rebel general Lakhwa Dada. Lakhwa Dada had reconciled with Daulat Rao Sindhya, and the War of the Widows was in hiatus as negotiations continued. Jaswant Rao Holkar was patiently biding his time, for he felt that the truce was not going to last, and there would be an opportunity for him to revive the glory of the Holkars. It was the middle of the year 1799 and the heat was terrible. Ranjit Singh was at Ramnagar, the former city of Rasulnagar, which had been captured and renamed by his father almost two decades earlier. He was resting when one of his attendants announced that a visitor from Lahore had arrived with a petition. The visitor was admitted and commanded to read the petition. Bismillah al-Rahman al-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most gracious and the most merciful, we the Chaudhrys of Lahore, make a humble representation to Sardar Ranjit Singh of Gujranwala, son of the most glorious Maha Singh. The piteous wailing of the people of Lahore suffering under the yoke of Sardar Sahib Singh, Sardar Chait Singh, and Sardar Mohr Singh has now reached the skies. After every period of difficulty must come a time of ease, just as every winter is followed by spring. The people of Lahore are God-fearing and worthy, and the buds that lie in their hearts yearn to flower, but they will not until the oppressive rule that they suffer ends. The most learned and the most humble citizens of Lahore beseech you to come to their aid and end this suffering. Men such as Mia Muhammad Ashik, Meher Mohkam Uddin, and the chief of the classical scholars, Muhammad Sabri, are all united in their opposition to Sardar Chait Singh, as well as Sardar Mohar Singh, Sardar Nab Singh, the son of Sardar Soba Singh, and his lieutenant Mangal Singh. The Hakims of Lahore do nothing for the people. They do not retain sufficient soldiers to police the city, and law and order cannot be maintained. The city suburbs have been completely devastated, and there are few houses left with intact roofs, as the rafters have been burned or have been taken away at the command of the Hakims. Even within the city walls, nearly half the streets are deserted, and the residents have fled several muhallas, fearing for their safety. The Hakims spent their time carousing, and in order to support their vices, they plunder the very citizens that it is their duty to protect. For all these reasons, we beg you to come to Lahore to relieve us of this oppression. Your august presence will be sufficient to end our suffering. You will not need to lift a finger. We shall do everything necessary. We just ask you to come and take charge of this once great city, which needs the benign oversight of a just ruler. United in their misery are your servants, Mia Muhammad Ashik, Meher Mohkam Uddin, Muhammad Sabri, Hakim Hakam Rai, Pai Gurbakh Singh, Muhammad Bakar, Muhammad Tahir, Mufti Muhammad Mukarram, and Mir Shadi. The young chief dismissed the envoy and addressed his courtiers. Is all this true? A lively debate broke out, several chiefs and commanders protesting that the Bhangis had ruled for years without the citizenry complaining, and others responding that while Sardar Gujjar Singh, Sardar Soba Singh, and Sardar Lena Singh had been men of honor, worthy of respect, their sons, who now ruled the city, were clearly lesser men. Huzoor, but does it even matter whether all this is entirely true or not? Proclaimed an elderly courtier in a soft voice. All eyes turned to the speaker, Qazi Abdul Rahman, a prominent Muslim cleric of Rasulnagar. As Ranjit Singh, understanding what the Qazi meant, nodded. Qazi Saab, said Ranjit Singh, you are right. This does present us with an opportunity, one that we have been thinking of and considering. And yet, we need to make sure that this is not a trap of some sort or an attempt by a dissatisfied Chaudhary or two to use our might to settle a score with the Bhangis. You will proceed to Lahore immediately and meet the signatories of the petition. Only after you return, satisfied that the support of the Chaudhrys is real and widespread, will we consider a move. The Qazi entered Lahore quietly and proceeded to meet with the signatories of the letter. They also introduced him to other notables, such as Hafiz Muhammad of Baghbanpura, Ahmed Khan Bhinder, Muhammad Bakar, Maulvi Muhammad Salim, Mia Muhammad Jan, and Hakim Hakam Rai. satisfied that all the leading Chaudhrys in Lahore were unanimous in their support for Ranjit Singh's capture of the city, Qazi Abdur Rahman returned to Rasulnagar, accompanied by Hakim Hakam Rai. Both the Qazi and the envoy were welcomed with great respect by Ranjit Singh, and kilats, or robes of honor, were conferred upon them. Ranjit Singh was pleased to learn that the Chaudhrys had also sent a letter to Sardarni Sada Kaur requesting that she join in the enterprise as well. Asking Qazi Abdur Rahman to return to Lahore to put a detailed plan in place, Ranjit Singh rode towards Batala to confer with his mother-in-law. Sada Kaur met him at Majita, accompanied by Sardar Nidan Singh Kanaiya and Diwan Dhanpat Rai, representing Sardar Jamal Singh Kanaiya. Sada Kaur, who was unequivocally the architect of Ranjit Singh's rise during the invasions of Shah Zaman, exhorted him to seize the moment. "Let us move swiftly, son." At Majita, they were met by Muhammad Azim Baghban, who was to serve as their guide as they got closer to Lahore. The combined Kanaiya and Shukar Chakia force, made up of 5,000 horse, arrived at the Shalimar Gardens on the outskirts of Lahore on the morning of July 4, 1799. Mia Muhammad Ashik and Meher Mokamuddin met them there and offered to help them enter the walled city through a breach that had been made between the Khizri and Yeki gates. Ranjit Singh politely declined, declaring that he would not enter Lahore like a thief, and set up a camp at the Baradari of Nawab Wazir Khan, a mansion with 12 doors. Sahib Singh was not in Lahore, but the two other members of the triumvirate were. Mohar Singh, in an attempt to curry favour with Ranjit Singh, sent his attendant Mangal Singh with sweets to welcome him. Rather than declaring his intentions, Ranjit Singh told Mangal Singh that he was bound for Gujranwala and requested him to arrange for boats so that his men could cross the Ravi. Visiting the docks, he made a show of distributing largesse and returned to his camp. Jath Singh, more circumspect, had ordered the gates to be closed and made preparations for the battle that he was sure was coming. A small detachment of Pangi warriors, numbering about 200, sallied forth but were beaten back into the city after 5 of them were killed by Ranjit Singh's forces. Mia Muhammad Ashik and Meher Mokamuddin sent word to Ranjit Singh that his men would open the Lahori gate for him the next morning and enable him to enter the city without a fight. The following morning, much to Ranjit Singh's consternation, the Lahori gate remained firmly shut. Some of the Chaudhrys of Lahore had either developed cold feet or had been shamed into not betraying their masters, and they refused to open the gates for the invading force. Mia Muhammad Ashik and Meher Mokumuddin sent urgent messages to Ranjit Singh to inform him, but it was too late and his men had already started their assault. The Shukar Chakia artillery thundered for several hours but made no impressions on the walls, forcing Ranjit Singh to retire. Mia Muhammad Ashik and Meher Mokumuddin worked tirelessly to convince the holdouts and also devised a stratagem. The following morning, as Lahori Gate was still heavily defended by Chet Singh's warriors, the Chaudhrys spread a rumour that Ranjit Singh had attacked the Delhi Gate, which was actually under attack by Sardarni Sada Kaur. Chet Singh's men abandoned the Lahori Gate in order to bolster the defences of the Delhi Gate, enabling the Chaudhrys to have the Lahori Gate flung open. Ranjit Singh thundered in through the open gate and dashed into the city, making straight for the mansion of Diwan Lakhpat Rai, who had been the scourge of the Sikhs during the reign of Zakaria Khan 60 years earlier. The mansion was now the residence of Sardar Mohar Singh, who ran away without offering a fight and took shelter in the house of a straw merchant where he was captured. Ranjit Singh treated him with kindness and allowed him to retire to his estates outside Lahore unmolested. Jaith Singh was rushing to the defense of the Delhi gate with 500 men when he got word that Ranjit Singh had already entered the city through the Lahori gate. The only safe haven left was the fort, and he quickly turned around and made for the Hazuri Bagh gate, managing to shut it and take shelter behind the thick walls of Lahore fort just in time before the Shukar Chakia cavalry arrived. Sardarni Sada Kaur, at the head of the Kanhaiya forces, joined Ranjit Singh and they laid siege to the fort. Intermittent artillery and matchlock fire was exchanged for several hours, with neither side gaining the upper hand. The young Shukar Chakia chief was frustrated, but his mother-in-law counseled restraint and asked him to suspend the assault on the fort. "We have caught them by surprise, son. The fort is not well provisioned, and Jaith Singh knows that he is heavily outnumbered. He cannot hold out for long. Besides, you are not here to plunder Lahore, but to rule it. A protracted siege would be terrible, as the residents of Lahore, who are to be your subjects, will suffer. We have to find a different way to resolve this." Her words proved to be prophetic, for the very next morning, Jaith Singh, who knew that he had been abandoned by the citizens of Lahore, sent a message to Sada Kaur to negotiate the terms of his surrender. The wily Sada Kaur had sent Mohar Singh to Jaith Singh to induce him to surrender, which he managed to do, assuring him that all the kindness that had been shown to him would surely be extended to Jaith Singh as well. Ranjit Singh, with the magnanimity that he was to show to all of his defeated foes throughout his life, allowed him and his 8 wives to leave Lahore with their property intact. As compensation for the loss of Lahore, Jaith Singh was awarded the village of Vernicky as his jagir. On July 7th, 1799, the new master of Lahore triumphantly entered the citadel. It was a stunning victory for Ranjit Singh. With minimal bloodshed, he had taken the capital of Punjab. The first thing that Ranjit Singh and Sardarni Sada Kaur did after taking the fort was to pay their respects at Dera Sahib, the site of the martyrdom of Guru Arjan. Had fallen, and the young conqueror of Lahore Fort was by himself in the northwestern part. He found himself in the Musamman Burj, the octagonal tower which the Mughals had named Shahi Burj, overlooking the Ravi. Just when he was entering the tower, he was startled by an apparition. For a second, he thought that he had seen the form of a tiger ready to pounce. As he blinked his eyes and backed up, he heard a voice. "Do not be afraid, O grandson of Sardar Jaith Singh Shukar Chakia. Come inside." Ranjit Singh, hesitating a little and wondering if he was walking into a trap, gingerly stepped inside, coming face to face with a frail old man with a white beard. "Who are you, Baba?" he asked. "Who I am is not important, but what I have to say is, listen, and listen carefully, Sardar Ranjit Singh. Speak then, Baba. I am listening. You are to be a great king, the kind of king that Punjab has not seen for 2,000 years. Maybe the kind of king the world has never seen before. You will rule this entire land and rise to heights your ancestors could never imagine." The young man smiled. "Thank you for your blessings, Baba, but I am no dreamer. I have taken Lahore today, but I am sure that Shah Zaman will be back to claim what is rightfully his. I have won a great victory, but I am one of many brave Sardars who walk this land and rule their fiefs. Besides, this is the way of the Khalsa. We are a sovereign people, but we don't have a king. For kingship was bequeathed upon all of us by our guru. You are not listening, young man. Heed my words, follow my advice, and everything I promised will come to a pass. Still smiling, the young man asked, Then tell me, Baba, give me your magical advice that will transform me into a mighty king. You talk of the guru. First and foremost, follow the path of your gurus and do not abstain from prayer for even a day. The descendants of Taimur were blessed by Guru Nanak himself, and they ascended to great heights of glory. Yet, when righteousness fled from the house of Babur, and the Mughals descended into treachery and debauchery, lusting after power, their mighty house was brought to ruin. Never make the mistake of holding court seated on the throne of the Mughal emperors. Do not forget that all temporal power is transient. Do not fall prey to the arrogance that hollowed out the mighty Mughals. Treat your subjects equally, with no regard for faith, caste, creed, or station. Men both high-born and low will flock to your side. Surround yourself with worthy men without regard for who they are and where they come from. And finally, I will send you a man of Allah, a healer who has the heart of a mendicant. Embrace him and honor him, for he and his sons are destined to serve you well. In a flash, the old man had vanished, just like the tiger that Ranjit Singh thought he had seen. Was it a dream? The young man asked himself. And he resolved to keep what he thought he had heard to himself, lest anyone think that he had taken leave of his senses. 10 days later, a grand darbar was held at Lahore Fort by its new conqueror. All the principal Chaudhries of Lahore and the wealthy bankers and merchants of the city were in attendance. They were all assured that his rule would be benign and he would rule with the highest regard for the honor of the citizens of Lahore and guarantee the safety of their personal property. All the 13 gates of the city would be manned by his men, and the city would be garrisoned with a large force that would guarantee law and order. All the Chaudhries who had supported Ranjit Singh's conquest of Lahore were awarded richly with titles such as Sahib and Meherban and invested with robes of honor. Meher Mohakam Uddin, the keeper of the Lahori gate, who had played a large role in Ranjit Singh's capture of the city, was honored with the title Baba and appointed the chief administrator of the city. Sardarni Sada Kaur had ordered cartloads of sweet and fragrant mangoes from Batala that were gifted to all the attendees of the Darbar. Ranjit Singh's capture of Lahore attracted the attention of the most important power brokers of the Indian subcontinent. Tales of his valor had already traveled outside the Punjab after his confrontation with Shah Zaman, and the taking of Lahore immediately got the attention of the Si Satluj Sardars, who ruled Patiala, Jind, Nabha, and Kapurthala. The news reached the Maratha court as well, and John Collins, the British resident attached to Daulatrao Sindhia, wrote to the Governor-General apprising him of the rise of Ranjit Singh. Shah Zaman, who was busy tightening his hold on his kingdom after ending the rebellion of his brother Mahmud Mirza, got word of Ranjit Singh's victory. The King of Afghanistan summoned his council for deliberations on the future of Punjab, which the Afghans had considered their territory since the days of his grandfather Ahmad Shah Abdali. When Shah Zaman's vizier Zabardast Khan asked him why he had been so insistent on returning from Lahore after the last campaign, he had not received a clear answer and had presumed that the king had decided to ignore his advice and listen instead to his great rival Sher Muhammad Khan, who had advocated returning. In the council, Shah Zaman told his advisors about a dream that had greatly disturbed him during his last expedition to Lahore. "I was in a grand darbar that was being presided over by the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Holy men, ascetics, Sufis, powerful chiefs, kings, all were in attendance. My joy at being in the Prophet's presence was supplanted by a feeling of dismay when he plucked the crown from my head and placed it on the head of a young man whose face I could not see clearly. In astonishment, I mustered the courage to ask the Prophet why my crown had been taken from me. The reply I got was what prompted me to leave Punjab rather than news of the rebellion in the West. 'This is not your time,' I was told. 'Punjab is now under the watchful eye of Guru Nanak. Now the meaning of the dream is clear to me, and the face of the young man has come into focus.'" Shah Zaman sent robes of honor to Ranjit Singh in August, confirming his overlordship of Lahore. His gesture was particularly helpful in addressing the anxieties of several of the prominent Muslim chiefs of the region, who had always regarded the Bhangi Hakims of Lahore as usurpers. In an effort to further win over the people of Lahore, Ranjit Singh immediately embarked upon a series of projects. The fort of Lahore had large stores of artillery and weapons that had fallen into disuse. Ranjit Singh engaged the city's artisans in repairing and refurbishing the weapons, paying them handsomely and generating tremendous goodwill. Driven either by the apparition that he had seen or simply by good sense, the young ruler of Lahore publicly visited the Badshahi Mosque, offering prayers of thanksgiving, greatly assuaging the fears of the Muslim residents, who had always been somewhat nervous about the intentions of their Sikh Hakims. The great Ahmad Shah Abdali, as well as his successor Taimur Shah, had during their reigns taken great care to ensure that they had the support of the powerful tribal chiefs of Afghanistan, as they understood the power that they wielded in a feudal society. In their times, no important campaigns were started without the consent and support of the feudal lords. Shah Zaman, in sharp contrast, had abandoned the policy of his grandfather, and while he paid lip service to the influence of the chiefs, he sidelined them and concentrated power in his council, relying heavily on his vizier Wafadar Khan. The most powerful of the chiefs came from the Baraksai family, whose patriarch Haji Jamal Khan had supported Ahmad Shah when he had been vying for the throne of Afghanistan. In return for his support, the position of vizier had been granted to him with the understanding that the throne would stay in Ahmad Shah's Sadozai clan, but the prime ministership would be the hereditary right of the Baraksais. In Taimur Shah's reign, Haji Jamal Khan's son Sardar Pende Khan had been vizier, but towards the end of his reign, Taimur Shah, fearful of Pende Khan's great influence, had replaced him with Fateh Allah Khan of Multan, who in turn was succeeded by his son Rahmatullah Khan. During the Battle of the Princes, after Taimur Shah's passing, Bande Khan had thrown his weight behind Shah Zaman and had ensured his succession, only to be disappointed when Shah Zaman confirmed Rahmatullah Khan as the wazir with the title Wafadar Khan. Thus, there was deep discontent in the Barakzai camp as they felt that they had been robbed of their legacy both by Taimur Shah and by Shah Zaman. Towards the end of 1799, after the threat from Mahmud Mirza had receded, Shah Zaman was at the zenith of his power. It was a time of prosperity, and it appeared that the Sadozai dynasty was at the cusp of a golden age. Fate, however, intervened in the form of Wafadar Khan, the vizier with the silken voice and courtly manner that disguised a jealous and avaricious heart. Little did Shah Zaman know how much his reliance on Wafadar Khan was going to cost him. The Rise and Fall of the Sikh Empire is brought to you by Almast Media, the creators of the Story of the Sikhs podcast and the Gurmat Sangeet podcast. The podcast features original music by Indian classical guitar maestro Ritam Sarkar. Tabla accompaniment is provided by Swarnava Ghosh. The podcast is made possible by the Chardi Kala Foundation, Ishpreet Singh and Manpreet Kaur, and the Sawhney Family Foundation. I am Sarpreet Singh, the writer and narrator, author of The Camel Merchant of Philadelphia, Night of the Restless Spirits, The Story of the Sikhs, Kultar's Mime, and The Sufi's Nightingale.